our HD2 schedule now features more local shows throughout the entire day, including a stellar mix of public affairs, music, comedy, and Spanish language programming, created and produced right here at KPFT. Don't miss a second on HD2. Mouse on over to kpft.org or on TuneIn Radio. KPFT Houston.
Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT Houston 90.1 FM. My co-host is Andrew Ferguson. Well, I mean, you're not obligated to say hi at this instant. You can say hi after the introductions.
I know, but I like to say it after my name is said so people know whose voice it is.
All right, we're still learning, folks. Anyhow, it's Saturday morning, early Saturday morning on April 4th. So unfortunately, you still can't call in, but we will try to make this show interesting in any event. Miss the callers, hope to have them back sometime in the near future. But COVID-19, we all make sacrifices. Just to rehash the usual stuff, the next election in Harris County is a runoff for July 14th. Other counties have reset their whatever elections or bond elections for other times. You can find your county clerks or go to the Secretary of State. Vote? I don't really remember, but it's votetexas.gov, and from there you can go to the Secretary of State's office. And you want to find your respective county clerks for your election information.
Yes, you do that you can search for your county name plus county clerk, and that should bring it up.
It should. But, you know, computers. So, I think we've been doing the last couple of shows in kind of a theme, which is the unanticipated short, medium, and long-term consequences of the COVID-19 pandemic that we have had. All of us, one way or another, have had to make adjustments in our lives, in our work, in our finances because of the circumstances created by COVID-19. So today, I think what we're going to focus on primarily, no question, no guessing where digressions take us, but primarily what I want to do is look at the restaurant and food business. Because that has been hit very, very hard. I mean, a restaurant that has to close, you can't get hit any harder than that. And for many restaurants, adjusting to takeout and delivery has been more than they can manage. So there have been varied degrees of success and lack thereof among the restaurants. So I thought it'd be interesting to touch on several stories that actually have appeared in the Houston Chronicle, same writer Greg Morago. The first one is Restaurants as Markets, Trend Thrives in Houston, that restaurants are offering grocery staples, fresh fruits and vegetables, and meats in addition to regular takeout, and that's proving popular as the Houston bar and restaurant dining ban continues. Now, this is really, really interesting to me. You know, the supermarket supermarket is a relatively recent invention. Supermarkets really didn't get going until about 60, 70 years ago, basically the 40s and 50s. And that puts small grocers, produce grocers, butchers, dry goods grocers, basically one way or another, those things became consolidated in the supermarket. There were some supermarkets that actually became cooperatives, like Associated New York, where you actually had people who specialized in these things become shareholders so that they basically were using common floor space, registers, etc., but they had put these functions under one roof.
Right.
In the last 20, 30 years, supermarkets have become so dominant that they're really, aside from supermarkets and convenience stores, for the most part, except for some real specialty things like Hispanic meat markets, halal, kosher, there really hasn't been much between the convenience store and the supermarket.
Yeah.
So this development among restaurants, because they're dealing all the time in fresh fruits and vegetables and meats, this is what they do every day for their business. Is this, in a sense, kind of the reinvention of the local staples market? Mm. Staple, not in terms of office supplies, but in terms of essential. Yeah. Well, you know, co-opted. But in terms of essential ingredients for people that don't necessarily want to go to a superstore that's two stories high and has a parking garage and is almost too big to walk or find anything. You know, in New York, if you've watched things like NYPD Blue and you know, various other procedurals set in New York City and maybe to a lesser extent Los Angeles, the term bodega is something we've all become familiar with in one way or another. Apparently, if you look this up, it talks about a small market shop. But apparently, depending on where you look it up, how that is defined becomes really flexible. In some cases, it's more of what in New York growing up we used to call a superette, which was really a little mini grocery store, not so much a convenience store. Or in other definitions, it's a little bit more of a liquor store than a small grocery store. But we're talking about something in a range of that. So if you're talking about Houston restaurants entering that space and Houston restaurants and bars entering that space, you can see how you can get a lot of overlap there. How much of this will continue? If some of these restaurants and restaurant bars that are finding some success in this, when they are able to reopen their dining space, will the neighborhood actually continue a demand on this service that some of these restaurant businesses will find justifies an ongoing business? What does that mean in terms of the future? I mean, just in terms of public service, I will be posting on the show blog these articles, and they do have lists of certain places that are doing this. I don't want to necessarily go into that list now. But, Andrew, like, what are your thoughts on this? You're a much younger guy than me, so you haven't seen the evolution, the emergence, the ending of different kinds of businesses like I have. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, you know, it's I've mentioned before that I actually don't live in Houston. I live in Pearland, and you know, it's more of a suburb, and so I don't really encounter. I mean, I don't think because the word bodega I don't think is really all that popular down here. So I don't really think that we have them. I'm very much willing to be corrected on that though. But I definitely don't have any chance of running into them out here in the suburbs. So it's, you know, this is for me this idea of restaurants having, doing double duty as markets, having the staples, like not having anything really extravagant, not having everything you need in one trip, but just having the things that you need every day. This is really something that I haven't seen before. And that makes it interesting. I mean, it's, It's obviously...
Consider that a restaurant generally has to source this stuff every day.
Yeah.
And in many cases, they get a little better variety of this stuff because this is their stock and trade. It's not Kroger. It's not HEB. It's not whatever other supermarket name you want to stick in there. This is what they do. The question is, can they transition to just doing a little more of it so that they can have another shop alongside their restaurant that essentially is selling their base ingredients?
Sure. Well, you know, this phenomenon of restaurants who weren't doing this before now offering some general goods is, I think, something that is directly attributable to shortages of staples like toilet paper specifically, as well as fresh fruits and vegetables, due to panic buying at grocery stores and supermarkets due to the coronavirus. And that's sort of the catalyst of all this. But a refrain that we continue to sing, I guess, in these past few episodes is it going to stand? Is it going to remain after all this is over, or all this has died down at least a little bit? And,
died down is not an expression we should be using.
Oh, perhaps. Yeah. After this has calmed somewhat, mm-hmm. perhaps. Now the idea of restaurants having general stores or having like goods that you can buy, like, having a store, you know, connected to the building is not an entirely alien one. I mean, you know, their Cracker Barrel is a good example. Other brands.
I mean,
really.
Arguably, this is just the reemergence of an old style of doing business in a new context.
Sure.
And, you know, once you have a business model, once they've gone to the trouble of establishing the space and the financial arrangements of what gets taxed and what doesn't and how the registers scan things and whatnot. You know, once you've set up a business model, if you find it's not costing you money, it's something that they might want to continue and build upon. Otherwise, sure. It's like the effort was a survival effort, and it's like, okay, you throw away the life preserver once you're rescued by the ship. But in some cases, they might find it's actually a niche for them.
Yeah, and the life preserver turns into quite a comfy fashion item, I guess.
Yeah, well, the life preserver now has turned into a survival boat with a cover and a zipper and all this other stuff, right?
Sure, sure. And you know, it's not being an expert in pretty much anything. I can't. Really extrapolate, you know, what kind of effects this would have on market trends. I can't guess at, you know, the longevity of this idea or this resurgence as it really is. But it is interesting. It's, you know, it's in times of crisis, you know, the community kind of pulls together to fill needs that aren't being filled. And this could be viewed as an example of that. It could be viewed as an example of the market adapting to changing conditions. It could be viewed as people who see an opportunity to make a quick buck. You know, there's a lot of different ways that you can look at it, but it's something to watch, certainly, and
it's definitely
to see,
a trend to watch.
Yeah, and to see if it helps you in your daily life by, you know, giving it a try maybe once if it's, you know, in your area.
So, time for a little break. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT Houston 90.1 FM. My co-host is Andrew Ferguson.
Hi there, folks.
We'll get this right.
Eventually, I don't usually do that during the breaks. I usually just do that at the beginning, but okay.
I'm just making it hard for you and myself at the same time. just so you know, you can follow what's going on at KPFT. We're not doing this stuff physically at the studio for the time being, but you can follow what's going on at KPFT by going to kpft.org. If there was ever a time you were thinking of contributing or supporting the station, now is a good time. A few bucks, a lot of bucks, you know, whichever way you can go would be great. Thinkwingradio.org, you can donate. Also, you can go and see the articles that I'm referring to by going to thinkwingradio.com. I do post the links for the articles that I am working off from my information, so you can not only see what it is I'm referring to, but also go into much more depth than I can or am able to during the show. Also, I'm on Twitter at Think Wing Radio. I'm also on Facebook, Think Wing Radio. Just, you know, it's kind of repetitive.
I do want to also quickly just specify, because we're not doing this at the station, we cannot take calls. Don't call in. And on the subject of donations, we would definitely love them. The station would definitely love them. But please only give if you can, because during an emergency situation, people often, their finances change. And, you know, yes. If you can't donate, if you were making donations that you can't do anymore, we understand. You know, we're not happy about it, but we understand. And, you know, ultimately what's important to us is that you take care of yourself, because, you know, we care about you.
Okay, so now going on to the next story, again, in a similar vein, and Greg Morago from The Chronicle wrote these some days apart, but I think that they all make kind of a nice story. From March 20th, Houston restaurants are doubling as mini markets amid coronavirus crisis. And he opens it up by saying, while so many restaurants had to quickly pivot to offering curbside service and takeaway meals, some are adding grocery options. And he does mention a couple that kind of repeat throughout his stories. One is Cuchara in Montrose, offering milk, eggs, fruit, vegetables, bread, and butter, in addition to a takeout menu. Benji's in Rice Village apparently has a pop-up market. Local Foods in Rice Village has a pop-up market. Good Dog Houston's on Studewood and on West Alabama. And again, you can go to the articles and see the locations and maybe do some research, having now been prompted.
And this article actually specifically says that Good Dog Houston has a bodega.
Yes.
So that's interesting, as that's another use of the actual word.
The bodega, and I have to admit, that is a term that popped up in very common usage in New York, apparently, long after I had moved away in 77. So I've never actually had a very clear idea of what a bodega is. And when we looked it up, apparently the definitions are really, really flexible.
Yeah.
But they are somewhere, depending on what bodega you go into, they are apparently somewhere between a convenience store and, let's say, a small supermarket.
Sure.
And, you know, it's not necessarily a place where you're going to get soft drinks or some other stuff. It's like a little market. So this could be a comeback. I mean, think about it. There are times, assuming that the price is competitive, doesn't have to be as cheap or cheaper, but if the price is competitive, they might have a slightly better quality of produce or a slightly better quality of meat, or it might simply be more convenient than going to a big market, certainly maybe for a lot of people closer to walking distance. You know, this could become a thing depending on what people become accustomed to and depending on what the bottom line ends up looking like once that these restaurants have already set up some infrastructure for doing this. I think that this could end up being a very interesting thing, a very interesting market segment to watch.
Yeah. And one other restaurant that is mentioned in the article is Indigo at 517 Barry. That's also going to...
Where is that? I have no idea where that is.
I don't either, but again, okay. I don't live in Houston, so I live
that,
in Maryland.
That street is familiar to somebody.
Yeah, but they're going to have a community pop-up market there as well. So, I mean, it's another sort of... You know, the specifics of the article would perhaps let us track how the phenomenon developed a little bit. Although, of course, these articles are really only 10 days apart, so I don't know if that's a long enough time to see changes in the trend. But, you know, if somebody, you know, keeps an eye on how these restaurants...
Greg obviously will.
Well, Greg obviously is. And he is on Facebook and Twitter, I believe, if you want to follow what he does. And, you know, maybe he'll tweet about this stuff. But, you know, if people keep an eye on the restaurants that are doing this, you may be able to figure out how successful this is. Other, you know, restaurants might start doing it, and that would be an indicator that it might be a good idea, might be a profitable idea. And, yeah, it's... It's another...
And of course, if you like the concept, if you visit the concept at one of these locations or another and like the concept, one way to perpetuate it is to support it.
Absolutely. And it's another change in our lives that is being affected by the coronavirus. And it is another reason to just keep an eye on what's going on and see how you can help people who need help, see how you can influence the trends that, you know, result in this, the ones that you like and the ones that you don't like. It's reason to pay attention to the world around you.
And actually, that leads nicely into the next story, which is, again, from Greg Morago, Houston Chronicle. New initiative supports Houston restaurants and feeds those in need. Mm. Crowdsource Rescue and Fund and Feed are providing meals for the elderly and healthcare workers and also for some restaurant workers. So one of the excerpts, when Anna Beaven found out that workers at a Houston cleaning firm were subsisting on junk food during long shift sanitizing city buses and police cars, she knew she had to do something. Just imagine the stress, she said, and not being able to eat properly. It's heartbreaking, said the owner of Cucharo Restaurant in Montrose. I wish they had something to eat that was prepared for them, but a lot of workers are not able to do that. So on Thursday, Beaven's restaurant, Cucharo, will deliver or has now delivered 140 sandwiches to ambassador services on the city's north side as part of a new project called Fund and Feed, providing meals to local elderly health care workers and those involved in containing the coronavirus. It was organized under the umbrella of a group called Crowdsource Rescue, and there are links in my on my webpage for this, a Houston-based disaster response nonprofit that is now using its rescue platform to help feed those in need as COVID-19 disrupts the food chain and dining routines. And it goes on a little bit more, you know, funds provided by the Busby Law Firm and HEB and helping to support some restaurants that are working in this project and taking a financial hit. And as of the writing of this article, which was, I believe, the 20th, about 1,000 meals have been purchased from restaurants and delivered to healthcare workers, the elderly, and those who might be overlooked during the coronavirus shutdown, such as janitorial and decontamination. Abby Kamen, city council, councilwoman from District C, who worked with Crowdsource Rescue during Hurricane Harvey, suggested to Matthew Marchetti, who is the co-founder of Crowdsource Rescue, that buying meals from local restaurants to distribute for free to those in need is a win-win because it supports the struggling restaurants during this time, as well as providing sustenance for people who are unable one way or another to obtain it. Mm. And if you go again to my website, you'll see links to these articles, further links to sources for these things. Andrew?
Yeah, this is another great example of the community pulling together to help people. And, I don't know if Crowdsource Rescue or specifically the Fund and Feed program are accepting volunteers in any capacity. And I honestly don't know the state of other food charities, mutual aid organizations. Food Not Bombs is one that I know of and is why I'm mentioning it, just because it's in my head, that under normal circumstances absolutely need volunteers and donations. But look into that. And there are also coalitions, mutual aid coalitions for COVID-19 or around the COVID-19 virus for people who need supplies but can't go out and get them themselves, whether they don't have the time because they're, you know, working double shifts, or whether they, you know, can't leave their homes, whether they're, you know, self-isolating or social distancing, or they're disabled and can't physically leave their homes.
And of course, there are a lot of neighborhoods that are food deserts.
Yeah. Oh, and absolutely. Yeah.
You know, that's a term where you have neighborhoods that are considered undesirable by the big companies. And this may be perhaps an entree into a new kind of market economy for them. If some of the restaurants that serve these so-called food deserts suddenly start seeing there is a way, and they may get assistance in this maybe from nonprofits or partners in the industry, there may be a way for them to help to support their community while also adding to their profit margins.
Yeah, because, the food desert is an area in which the staples of a diet are, you know, either not available because there's not a business that sells them within, you know, this area or within a reasonable distance from the area. Forgive me, I don't know the exact definition. I believe there is a grocery store or something like that in the area, but its prices are out of reach of the average resident of that area.
Because it's not part of a chain.
Because
it's an independent supermarket in a food desert with very little local competition.
Yeah.
I mean, we're not so much predicting what will happen, but what we're doing here and in the last couple of shows and perhaps in future shows, we're just looking at how this is going to create some societal and technological and social and habitual changes. People that have been accustomed to doing things one way now all of a sudden are being forced to find other ways of doing things. And once things return to normal, the new ways that people have found to do things, they won't go away. They'll still be there in some form, and people will still utilize them in some way, and they will evolve into new things.
And I am really, really glad that you actually brought up food deserts, because that is a problem that various NGOs and nonprofits have been trying to figure out solutions for. And I would imagine from the lack of success that they've had in eliminating them that this idea of restaurants providing grocery shopping options at, you know, those places either hasn't been tried before, or there haven't been enough restaurants willing to do it in the area, or there haven't been restaurants in the area. And in that case, you know, food trucks that are mobile and can come into the area temporarily may be a good solution for that. But this idea of restaurants providing grocery shopping options may be one of the ways that food deserts can be effectively combated. And that
again,
would be
we're talking about restaurants simply retailing the stuff that they have to source every day anyway.
Mm. So it's not like you have to go
out of the
way.
There's a lot of synergy. Exactly. Yeah. There's a lot of synergy there. You are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM. My co-host is Andrew Ferguson.
You gestured to me that time.
I don't know what he's going to do. Yes, I paused for a moment, and that was my mistake.
Yes.
You see, we're doing this on like Skype and Duo at the same time, so it's like I can see him on my monitor, but he can see me on his phone. This is the new world we're in, folks. We're all improvising as we go along. I forgot he could see me, so I guess unconsciously, because I talk with my hands, I'm from New York, I'm Jewish, I'm old, you know, it's just that kind of thing. Anyway. So 90.1 FM, Houston, KPFT.org will let you find out what shows are on. You can go to our archive. You can go to our news pages. You can see what various shows are doing. A lot of shows are doing remote, so you're not necessarily getting reruns on everything.
Yeah,
there are a lot of shows that you can podcast, like Hint Hint Hours.
Yeah,
you can podcast our show.
I'm really impressed, actually, and this is I'm doing my best not to make this a backhanded compliment. I am really impressed by how many KPFT shows are still doing pre-recorded broadcasts or remote broadcasts where that's possible.
Shows, essentially.
Yeah. It's because, you know, it would be so easy and very justifiable, frankly, to say, hey, look, I can't come into the studio, so I can't really do a show. And that's fair. And I don't begrudge anyone who's made that decision. But the fact that we at this station love what we do, we love, you know, imparting our wisdom and our knowledge onto
such
the community.
Yes,
such as it is, onto the community. And we love, you know, making sure that people have something to, you know, keep their minds busy during all this. You know, it's it reminds me why I love KPFT, and hopefully why you love KPFT.
And really, the idea behind doing the shows that we're doing right now, that ThinkWing is doing the shows we're doing the content we're doing, and the way we're doing it, I have really wanted to emphasize that we don't have to live just in the moment.
Yeah.
I realize it's a big moment.
Yes.
And for some people, it's a really fragile, maybe even catastrophic moment.
Mm.
But, you know, this too shall pass, and the world will have changed as a result in many ways. I mean, we're talking locally, regionally, nationally, geopolitically. We can't even begin to foresee the unintended consequences and butterfly effects. But there will be some, and
yeah,
the world will go on. You know, we've changed our outro music to the theme from the Poseidon Adventure, that there's got to be a morning after, because there will be. At
yeah.
some point, there will be a morning after. So I think that talking in this particular case about what restaurants are trying to do in terms of new business models or community service or relief programs or cooperating with nonprofits where it's a win-win for the restaurant and the nonprofit, these are all things that I think are obviously being reported, because I'm pulling this, in this case, off the Chronicle, but maybe underreported, insufficiently discussed, insufficiently noticed. And this is stuff that's going on that's going to make changes in
yeah.
how we live in some form after.
Yeah. And, you know, it's and you know, you mentioned that we don't just have to live in the moment. And it is a very serious and catastrophic moment for a lot of people. And that's, you know, that's absolutely true. But and do what you need to do to get through this. Absolutely do what you need to do to get through this. But it's not reason to stop thinking about what could be. It's not reason to give up on the things you still want to do. It's not reason to stop, you know, going outside. It's not reason to, except, you know, where you try and stay 6 feet away from other people. That's a, you know, very fair thing to do when you go outside. But it's we've still got to live our lives, you know, and
living is planning.
Yeah.
You know, there's a saying that life is too short. Sometimes, though, life is too long. There's a saying that sometimes you have to live as if there's no tomorrow. Mm. On the other hand, you have to live as if there is.
Yeah.
So it's all finding that balance between whatever it is you're doing to survive now,
yeah.
but also understanding that there will be stuff that you can look forward to that may actually create opportunities for you, or at least possibilities for you.
Yeah.
And it's not just a hopeless situation. There will come a point where you will be able to look forward again.
Yeah. And in that vein, you know, looking forward to, you know, the things you can do to help other people. You know, if you need help, reach out. If you can provide help, reach out to the people who need it. And, you know, that, 'cause that's how we're going to get through this. That is how we get through anything, is by working together and helping the people who need help, and, you know, doing, you know, everything that we can whenever we can. And that's what's important.
Forward looking is a topic we're going to come back to shortly. But there's one more story that I wanted to touch on. Again, Greg Morago doing heavy lifting for me at the Houston Chronicle. This is from March 30th, so recent. The Houston restaurant community helps feed itself. With thousands of area bar and restaurant workers unemployed, the hospitality industry has been busy working to feed those in Houston, or feeding those who fed Houston. And part of the article says, with thousands of area bar and restaurants unemployed, the hospitality industry has been busy working to feed those who feed Houston. Over the weekend, last weekend, Riel restaurant switched gears, turning itself into a drive-up spot for free takeaway dinners for Houston restaurant workers who have lost their jobs. Something to keep in mind if you've worked in that industry. There are
yeah.
resources for you.
Yeah.
The Riel owner, Ryan Lachane, I think is the name, how it's pronounced. It's heartbreaking what's going on. The majority of them lost their jobs overnight. Things need to get done right now. folks are in trouble now. We need to step up today and do something. You know, it's the old saying, people don't eat in the long term.
Yeah.
People now. So on a previous Saturday, the Montrose Restaurant launched the Houston arm of the Restaurant Workers Relief Program. There is a link in the article. It's a partnership between the Lee Initiative and Maker's Mark to feed restaurant workers in need. Lee is based in Lexington, Kentucky, and established the program in cities including Atlanta, Boston, Chicago, Denver, L.A., Seattle, New Orleans, and Washington. Restaurants in participating cities prepare hundreds of to-go meals for restaurant workers who've been laid off or had their work hours reduced. The Houston Texans quarterback, and again, not following sports, Deshaun Watson, made a financial contribution to the Lee Initiative to help feed hospitality workers. And there are links in the article if you go to my website, and you can go to all of these. So many resources that unless you're reading Greg Morago, you might be unaware of.
I didn't
find these until I did a literal search for restaurants in crisis.
Yeah.
And that's when a lot of these articles popped up. So, you know, if you haven't run across this kind of information, it might be useful to you.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is to kind of shift to a broader discussion, I guess, recently for a moment. This is why I've started to say that, you know, access to information is really now a basic human need, like food, water, and shelter, because this is how not only you keep connected with the world, this is how you find help when you need help. You know, going on the internet and searching, you know, support for restaurant workers, support for laid off factory workers, support for, you know, people who support for seasonal workers, even, you know, and this is how you find that help. And of course, ask your neighbors, talk to people as well on the phone, ideally. But, you know, this is why it's so important that we ensure that people have the ability to go down to their local library if they need to get access to the internet, or, you know, better yet, although this is openly left wing, you know, provide people with
KPFT horrors.
Provide people with, you know, laptops and internet access, you know, and just make sure that people can figure out what it is that is out there for them.
Well, I think that this is a good moment to point out that it has long been said that knowledge is power.
Yes.
But to build on what Andrew was saying, this also shows that knowledge is survival. When we have a crisis, whether it's a hurricane, whether it's a pandemic, whether it's a drought, knowledge is survival. And if you don't have the means to get on the internet, the rarely called these days World Wide Web, because it's really important to conceptualize it that way.
Yeah.
This is how you find out what resources are available for you to survive, to live day to day, to advance yourself. Otherwise, you're living in a little narrow parochial world where you have no idea what resources are available to keep you going.
Yeah.
So on that note, let me do a quick ID again. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT Houston. This is a pre-recorded show.
Yes.
We're on 90.1 FM. Please do not call. We miss our callers, but unfortunately, we can't take them for the time being. We're doing this pre-recorded. You can go to my website to get more information on these things at thinkwingradio.com. Just look for when it's posted, the current show blog post. Also, kpft.org is where you can find out what's going on at the station, or if you have the means to help support us during this difficult time. And also, after this show, I believe that Clint Broussard has been providing new editions of Blues and Hi-Fi.
Yes.
And that will most likely be following us right after this show ends. I didn't know if we would get to this during this episode, but I think it's a great story, not from Greg Morago. Actually, this is from the TexasMonthly.com. They've taken down the paywall on this story, so you can click on the link that I provide in my blog post and read. It's really a pretty lengthy, fascinating story. It's entitled Inside the Story of How HEB Planned for the Pandemic. The grocer started communicating with Chinese counterparts in January and was running tabletop simulations a few weeks later. Parentheses, but nothing prepared it for the rush on toilet paper. This is by Dan Solomon and Paula Forbes from March 26th. And I've excerpted a little bit. The San Antonio-based HEB has been a steady presence amid the crisis. The company began limiting the amounts of certain products available to purchase in early March. They extended sick leave policy, implemented social distancing measures quickly, limited hours to keep up with the needs of its stockers, added a coronavirus hotline for employees in need of assistance or information, and gave employees a $2 an hour raise beginning March 16th as these workers, many of whom are interacting with the public daily during the pandemic, began agitating for hazard pay. This isn't the first time HEB has done a good job of managing a disaster. Oops, and I just lost my page. See, I'm scrolling. I'm not printing this stuff out. So now it's like I hit the wrong button.
I can pick up for you if you want.
I hit the wrong button. Anyway, all right, hold on. Let me just get my cursor in the right place. You see, folks, this is contemporaneous pre-recorded radio.
The trials of video conferencing and online communications.
We're struggling like you are. To go on with the story, this isn't the first time HEB has done a good job of managing disaster. It played an important role in Gulf Coast recovery from Hurricane Harvey, which led the writers of the story to ask, how did a regional supermarket chain develop systems that allow it to stay ahead of a crisis as big as this one? Frankly, it sort of made me wonder, and I know there must be some, but I wonder what kind of planning was done at the big stores like Kroger and like Rice and like so many other big supermarket chains, regional, national, because they really did a lot of work here. I mean, when you go through this article, it's really kind of astounding. The writers spoke with nearly a dozen employees, executives, and customers to understand how HEB has taken this unique role in shaping its business around the needs of their, in their words, of Texans in the midst of trying circumstances. Justin Noakes is the director of emergency preparedness at HEB, and I kind of like this little bit here. He said, just a little bit of history. These are his words, essentially. We have been working on our pandemic and influenza plan for quite a while now, since 2005, when we had the threat of H5N1 overseas in China. He says that's when we first developed what our plan looked like, as well as some of our requirements and business implications. In 2009, we actually used that plan in response to H1N1 when the swine flu came to fruition and refined it and made it more of an influenza plan. And they've continued to revise it. Now, I don't have the excerpts here, but in the article it says they've actually been in contact with Chinese suppliers to coordinate with them and have a greater understanding of what their experience was in China when COVID-19 first began to break out, and, of course, the way the Chinese clamped everything down in order to try to break the chain of infection. It's really an astonishing article. I can't read the whole thing, although with the time going the way it is, maybe I'm going to wish that I had. But I'm going a little faster than I expected. I thought I would have plenty to talk about, but I've got more stuff if needed. But Andrew, so, I mean, you have the article. I sent it to you. What did you think of it? It's really quite amazing.
Yeah, it is. I mean, specifically talking about how, you know, disaster preparedness plans that they made for a totally different, like, specific circumstance, even though it's, you know, the same kind of preparedness, reminded me actually of what New York, your home, Mike, did around the Y2K scare. And just, you know, a quick aside, the Y2K scare was a serious problem. Like, there were a number of software, you know, that was a number of different software applications that were in use that really did not handle the two-digit 2000 year. And, you know, because people tested their systems with OO dates and they crashed, and or they, you know, acted otherwise in ways that they didn't want. And so, you know, that's why there was so much money spent around the turn of the millennium to address this. Obviously, this is all from history that I've read and watched. I wasn't, you know, cognizant at the time to actually notice any of this. But and obviously there would have been some fraud in there, but the majority, I think, or at least half of, you know, the money that was spent for good reason. But specifically New York, around Y2K, there, they had made updates to systems. They had made plans for if power and water and other utilities got interrupted, you know, how they would reroute that, how they would stay in touch with emergency services. And this ended up proving very useful when 9/11 happened, because obviously that would have that threw the entire city into chaos, and you know, utilities were interrupted, emergency services, you know, people were, you know, lost contact, and because they had planned for admittedly a different emergency, but it was still, the effect was similar. They had planned for the same problems in the wake of whatever disaster it was. And that reminds me of this, because it just, it goes to show how much it pays to prepare, especially if you're a large company or if you're a government or a municipality. And even if you're
a private citizen. Yeah, we're learning that.
Yeah.
Oh, and here's my cat. You see, this is what happens with my live pre-recorded broadcasting. I woke her up. Just looking at the article, they went through a process of preparing employees. So the first coronavirus case in Texas was found. I'm having trouble parsing this. In February 12th, I think is what the article is saying.
Okay.
So they reduced their store hours to 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. And apparently their partners, their suppliers responded very well. Their volume was up in their stores. They were very dedicated. The employees very dedicated and engaged. Tina James, who is the chief people officer, which I guess would be HR in other companies, says she was both amazed and humbled by how positive their employees were in terms of their spirit and how great they felt to be serving their customers. You know, it really comes down, and I mean, I can't speak to HEB outside of this article, but it always comes down to culture.
Yeah.
You know, I have had good experiences with companies and bad experiences with companies, and what I have found, it always comes from the top down. It's always about modeling behavior. And when you at least read this story, it seems like the behavior that's been modeled from the top is attention to detail, dedication to product and service, consideration of the entire human chain that goes into making this work. I would love to know if there is anything comparable or what might have been happening comparable in other food chains or other food stores.
Yeah.
Did they go through anything remotely like this kind of preparation? Less, more, different, how?
Well, you know, I believe, I wish I could remember the specific thing. I think it's, I think it was the workers wanted sick pay, wanted paid sick leave for people who got coronavirus.
Yeah, Amazon is one. I think Walmart was another.
But this one specifically was Kroger. Kroger actually had some workers strike in a few locations, I believe, or almost did. If they didn't actually do it, again, this is remembered stuff. I can't give a source for this. I wish I could, but it's that is at least from what I can remember, an illustration of how differently members of an industry can react to situations like this. And, you know, ultimately, I think at least it seems to me from this article, what HEB has done here is kept in mind that ultimately people matter, whether it's customers or whether it's employees. And, you know, when people matter to you, you'll matter to people. And so it's that kind of attitude that really helps businesses weather storms like this. And, you know, it's why I think one of the key reasons why HEB's emergency preparedness plan has been so successful.
Essentially, people aren't just commodities in a business.
Yeah.
You know, when you talk to socialists, they're always saying that the workers are really the source of capital. The workers are the source of productivity. And while that can be overworked as a socialist theme, it isn't untrue.
Yeah.
I mean, without their workers, companies can't function. Mm. And moving toward the kind of structure we have today, the kind of, I hate to use the word except that I no longer do, the oligarchical structure that we have today, the oligopolist culture that we have today, where so few companies and so few people own so much of the business and wealth and productivity of the country, it's been easy to see human beings in that sort of corporate, nobody's legally responsible context as just commodities that can be replaced or utilized or extensively overutilized.
Yeah.
You know, the old expression, you're just going to have to do more with less, that I often comment means that at some point you would have to do everything with nothing.
Yeah.
You have to value your people. And when your people feel valued, they will return the compliment. You know, there are people right now running our country who want absolute loyalty, but give none.
Yeah.
It is a two-way street. For things to function well, loyalty is a two-way street. Yes, Andrew.
That's our 6-minute warning, actually. Sorry.
Yeah, he stuck up his hands, and I wasn't sure if he was giving me a time, which I do have my clock on, or if he was trying to say something. I'm going to let him talk while I feed my cat, who's really, really clawing at me right now.
Oh,
I'll be right
boy.
Back. Give me a minute.
Sure. Okay, well, it's, you know, I don't know how much more I can say on the HEB story. I think we have kind of gotten our essential message about it out. But, you know, it's really important to, you know, keep in mind, just to hammer this home, that people matter. And not just in the business sense. And, of course, you know, the in my opinion, the ultimate way a business can value its people is to make it a co-op and give them a vote. But, of course, that's not always practical. But even in outside of business, even in your community, people matter. And, you know, that's why we care about, you know, supporting, you know, community efforts, supporting mutual aid efforts, and supporting people who want to help other people in these trying times.
You know, one of the things that we've talked about is the technology to do things like remote pre-recorded broadcasts and how that's going to change the world. One of the problems we obviously have is cats, dogs, and children. So,
that's,
you know, this is a pre-recorded show, but it's being done in real time.
It is. I don't know if I'd exactly say that cats, dogs, and children are problems, but, you know.
Well, in media, I mean, here it is. It's live. I think that even one of the late night hosts had his kids jump in and had to deal with that. So, you know, this is real life now. Sure. I'm going to do a quick station ID, and then we're going to take the last several minutes. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT Houston 90.1 FM. This is pre-recorded on April 4th, early in the morning. So please don't call. But we hope in the relatively near future we'll be able to speak with our listeners again. KPFT.org is where you go to find out how we're keeping all this going during this time when we are not physically in the station. We do have a few people. Bobby is one, and he keeps things going. And Judon Boney has been helping to organize. He's our interim general manager. So, I mean, there aren't that many paid staff in KPFT. So these folks really are what's keeping us on the air right now. We're just pre-recording stuff at home. They actually have to go there.
Yeah, and Naboo is keeping us in contact with everybody. And, you know, really, even though, you know, we can't be there to help, I mean, we honestly can't thank them enough for letting us still talk to people on the airwaves, you know, because
and working with us to make this as easy as it can be under difficult circumstances.
Yeah.
I do want to point out, because it is sort of important, that everything we're talking about, you can see references to it at thinkwingradio.com. I'm not just doing that to drive traffic to my site, although I don't mind. But it really is important that you are able to see links to these stories so that you can get the greater detail that these stories have.
Yeah.
One of the things that I'll get to, since we do have a couple of minutes, I'll at least touch on it. There was a story from Reuters on March 29th entitled "White House-led airlift of urgently needed medical supplies arrives in New York." Now, there are a couple of things that have come to light from this. One of them is that apparently the supplies are going to warehouses. So it's going to go into the commercial supply chain, which isn't quite the same thing as urgently needed medical supplies going to New York. The other thing, and I only found one story that actually said it, all these supplies are coming from China.
Yeah. Hmm.
So,
that's interesting.
Yeah. It's like what we have done. I mean, people like me who have seen this process evolved since the 70s, I have been concerned as a national security issue, not just an employment issue, about how much of our materiel, how much of our clothing, our basic supplies, our camera optics, I mean, all kinds of things are now sourced from outside. Our random access memory, in some cases, our computer central processing units, CPUs.
Mm-hmm.
This is a wake-up call. It isn't just about profit. It isn't just about companies finding the cheapest place to produce something, and it isn't entirely about whether there is one place that does it so much better than another place. You know, maybe Germany or Japan make absolutely great optics, but does that mean we shouldn't have the capability of doing the best we can as a national security issue to have someone here who can make things like optics or surgical masks or personal protective equipment? Or clothing, or, you know, whatever it is, we need to have a national supply chain. But that'll be a topic for another show. Okay, we have about 50 seconds left, more or less. You've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM. My co-host, Andrew Ferguson, indispensable at this time. Nice to have at other times, but indispensable at this time. KPFT.org is how you follow up on the station. ThinkWingRadio.com is how you keep track of the show. We are available to podcast. You can go to your iPhone or Android podcast app. I'm still too old to be very verbal in those things. Thank you for listening. Andrew, anything you want to say in the last few seconds to wrap up?
Yes, Clint Broussard with Blues and Hi-Fi is up next, we hope. Tune in for that, or stay tuned for that, because that's a great show, and everybody needs a little bit of music in this trying time. So,
and we'll be back next week. Look forward to speaking to you again. Bye-bye.
See you later. It's not too late.
Have been in your car looking for news coverage or some new music. Maybe you were at home scanning the dial looking for something different. Your radio may have settled on KPFT and stayed there. If you're new to this station, here's how community radio works. We rely on listeners, not advertisers, for money. And it's not money for nothing. We use this money to operate our station. We hold membership drives a few times a year, and we ask for you to support our work with a pledge. If you give a call to 713-526-4000 and ask for the membership department or go to kpft.org, you can pledge an amount of your choice to support KPFT. You've come to rely on us, but we would be in dire straits without you. This is listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio KPFT Houston.
Want to help KPFT but can't make the drive out to the Little House on Lovett Boulevard? A great way to aid KPFT is as simple as logging into Facebook and Twitter. Connect with KPFT via social media. It's simple. Just visit twitter.com/KPFT and facebook.com/KPFT Houston. Then share our links and donate form with your social circles on Twitter and Facebook. Chances are you know